rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Schmidt, Judge Sleater, Judge Wheelock, the Honorable Judge John Schmidt presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated.
Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is March 21st. We have three cases on for argument today. And I'll ask the marshal to go ahead and call the first case.
The first case is A23-1622, Nathan Alexander Jefferson, appellant, versus Drew Evans, et al. Respondents.
All right. We have audio recordings of the proceedings will be made, and they'll be made available shortly after arguments today. Each side will have 15 minutes for your presentation. Appellant counsel, you'll have 5 minutes for your rebuttal. When you're ready, you can go ahead and get yourself set up. There's a button in the middle there that you can raise and lower the podium. I know you're both very familiar with that. So when you're ready, please proceed.
May it please the court.
Counsel.
My name is Bradford Colbert, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Nathan Jefferson. The issue in this case is whether the state can constitutionally require Mr. Jefferson to register as a predatory offender based on an offense that occurred almost 30 years ago. We raise several reasons why requiring Mr. Jefferson to register is unconstitutional, but this morning I want to focus on why requiring him to register violates his constitutional right to substantive due process. I'll leave the other issues to my brief, although of course I'll be happy to answer any questions the court may have regarding those issues. I want to briefly review the facts because they are important in understanding the issue and why requiring Mr. Jefferson to register as a predatory offender violates his constitutional right to substantive due process. In 1995, Mr. Jefferson got into an argument with his girlfriend that led to a physical altercation. Following the incident, Mr. Jefferson was charged with third-degree assault. There were no allegations of inappropriate sexual misconduct. Before trial, the state and Mr. Jefferson agreed to a plea deal. The state offered to dismiss the third-degree assault charge if he would agree to plead to a lesser offense of false imprisonment. As part of the deal, the parties agreed to a prison sentence of 28 months. In 1995, neither third-degree assault nor false imprisonment were registrable offenses. So there was no discussion of whether he would have to register or what the future might mean. No one had any idea that they would change the law. And so on March 26th of 1996, Mr. Jefferson pled guilty to false imprisonment. Essentially, he said he would not let his girlfriend out of the car.
Counsel, had he pled guilty to the charged offense, would he have to register?
No, Your Honor. That's exactly what makes this particularly peculiar.
And counsel, is it true that when he pled guilty to the most recent offense that led to the calculation or determination based on the statute that he must register, am I correct that at least by the time he had his sentencing hearing, I don't know if it was prior to that because he saw it in the PSI, that there may be this concern, but he decided he wanted to go through with sentencing anyway.
That's correct, Your Honor. It wasn't defined. And interestingly, of course, in this registration law in Minnesota is so confusing because it doesn't really matter what the sentencing court says, because the sentencing court does not get to determine registration. If, for example, the sentencing court had decided you needed to register and the BCA looked at it and determined that he wouldn't have to register, then he wouldn't have to register. So the discussion around sentencing really has nothing to do with registration.
And would it be true that would also not be a basis under Rule 15 to withdraw one's plea of guilty?
That's correct, Your Honor.
A judge could do it in the judge's discretion, I suspect, but it would not be obligated to, and that probably would be upheld on appeal.
That's correct, Your Honor, because this registration is considered to be, an air quotes and purposely, collateral consequence. And that idea is the BCA in 2021 told me you'd have to register. And that was the determination. It wasn't the sentencing court, because the sentencing court does not have the authority. In fact, there's a statute that says that exact thing. The Stenson court has no authority over registration.
But counsel, he was aware that it was a possibility at that time that he would have to register when he went forward. Okay,
yes,
thank you.
That was clear. That was a possibility. So requiring him to register under these circumstances violates his constitutional right to substantive due process. Substantive due process protects against wrongful government actions regardless of the procedures. The level of scrutiny to be applied depends on whether there's a fundamental right implicated. Although we believe that registration should involve a fundamental right, the Minnesota Supreme Court disagrees. And so we are subject this case to a rational basis review. And the rational basis standard of review requires that the act serve to promote a public purpose, that the act not be an unreasonable, arbitrary, or capricious interference with the private interest, and third, the act must bear a rational relation to the public purpose to be served. In this case, the requiring Mr. Jefferson register meets none of those factors.
Counsel, you're not disputing, I don't believe, that he qualifies for registration under the statute, the 167, or is it the, 167.
That's correct, Your Honor.
My question is this. A couple times in your brief, I noticed that you made reference to suggesting it was error for the commissioner, I guess, to have required the registration, but you don't dispute that the statute requires it. Here's my question, getting to the constitutional issue. What basis would the commissioner have, who swears to uphold the law as well, to make a determination, arguably on a case-by-case basis, and you certainly have sympathetic, empathetic facts here, to say, no, this would be arbitrary and capricious? Do you believe that the commissioner has that authority under the law to make that determination?
That's a great question, Your Honor. And quite frankly, I think that, in fact, the commissioner does. And the commissioner can say, or the BCA, the superintendent who makes the determination regarding, does have the authority to say, this is, in fact, unconstitutional, require this person to register. It's a matter of equity, and I think that the BCA, although it's not in the statute, I would suggest that they have the right to say, to follow the Constitution and conclude that this would violate this person's constitutional right to substantive due process. I think they would. They, in fact, never do that. You know, their position is the statute, we just follow the statute. But I think that they would have the right to, although they don't exercise that right.
And how would, I'm just thinking in that scenario, how would it make it to our court? Who would be because that's an arm of the state. Would it be the Attorney General separately to say, well, no, we disagree with you and either force it or somehow bring it to our court in a reverse situation?
And again, it goes to the peculiar nature of the registration statute in Minnesota, the idea of that the BCA makes this determination and they don't, you know, it's not, they just look at the statute. There isn't a process by which they make the determination. They just look at the statute and then they determine that. And the only way that I know of is to challenge that is to file a 1983 action or some type of civil action saying he doesn't have to register, which would be different if the registration was in fact imposed by the sentencing court. But that's not the way it works in Minnesota, and Minnesota is particularly peculiar about how it does that. And I think the court, that makes this a much more difficult exercise for all those reasons. So the idea that this statute promotes a public purpose, the purported public purpose is to assist law enforcement in investigating sex offenses, in particular sex offenses against children. And obviously investigating and preventing sex offenses against children is an important public purpose, but it's not enough for the state to simply articulate a public purpose. The purported purpose must be served by the statute, and requiring registration to help the state investigate sex crimes is like painting a car to make it go faster. The two are simply unrelated. And this is for several reasons. First, the law itself is based on a false assumption that people who commit crimes are significantly more likely to commit crimes in the future. This was based on an assertion by Justice Kennedy in McCune versus Lilly, who wrote that the recidivism rate of untreated offenders has been estimated to be as high as 80%, a frightening and high risk of recidivism. This unsupported assertion was based on a reference in an amicus brief, a reference that relied on an article in Psychology Today written by a counselor, not a scholar, that did not provide any evidence to support the assertion. Unfortunately, other courts, including the Minnesota Supreme Court, have simply repeated this phrase without questioning its underpinnings. And we actually now know that the data shows that people who commit sex offenses are not more likely. In fact, they're less likely. So it's based on a flawed assumption.
Counsel, recently our court, it was a non-precedential opinion, but in the Nguyen versus Evans case, rejected very, very similar arguments. Beyond it being non-precedential, how do we distinguish that case?
I think that's fair, Your Honor, and it's difficult, right? Because this is, I think this particular case, this peculiar set of circumstances, where this person is being forced to register as a result of a charge for which it was dismissed, I think that makes it different in that idea. But it's non-precedental. And quite frankly, it is time for the Minnesota appellate courts to step in. It is this beyond time. And this idea of the registration in Minnesota, as we have 20,000 people being forced to register, and the BCA simply says we're following the statute, it's time for the court to take seriously these issues of constitutional violations. And this idea, and again, there's no allegations of sexual misconduct. And I want to emphasize what registration does. For example, before being admitted to a healthcare facility, he must inform the provider that he is a predatory offender. And then law enforcement must prepare a fact sheet that lists the name and physical description of the offender's conviction history, the risk level classification, and the profile of likely victims. And then this fact sheet not only has to go to the healthcare facility, it is supposed to go to every resident in the facility before he's admitted. So this is why this court needs to step in, and in particular in this case.
Counsel, how do we, there's a number of Minnesota Supreme Court cases that we would have to do some legal gymnastics if we were to agree with you. As an error-correcting court, how do we get there?
Yeah, and unfortunately, a few of those are my cases, so I will be, that's the downside. I think, again, what this court could rely on the peculiar set of circumstances, and what makes this case different is the idea the charge, the original charge that he was charged with, third-degree assault, he would not have to register. If he had simply pled guilty to that offense, he would not have to register as a predatory. The only reason he is being required to register is because the state offered him a deal to plead guilty to a lesser offense. To require someone to register under those circumstances is absurd. And it does not fit with the purpose of the statute. The purpose of the statute is to create a database of people who commit sex offenses. So it came up in the wake of the tragic Jacob Wetterling, where the idea was if someone has kidnapped a child, we want to have a database of people who might have committed this crime so we can go find the child. That's the purpose of the statute. This requiring Mr. Jefferson to register is so far from that purpose. It is beyond that purpose.
So, counsel, if I understand this correct, the lesser charge that he pled guilty to was the false imprisonment. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
False imprisonment is included as a registrable offense now.
It is.
Registrable offense.
Yes.
And it doesn't seem to me that offense is inherently something that indicates that someone was a sexual offender or a predatory to minors either. So it seems to me that you might be asking us to decide whether or not it's appropriate for false imprisonment to be a registrable offense when that is within the purview of the legislature.
I If he had, I mean, it'd be a different argument if the state had not agreed to reduce the charge. That was what makes this peculiar, because the original offense was third degree assault. If he had just said, "I'm guilty of third degree assault," pled guilty, he would not be have to register. So the idea that the state can reduce the charge and then have later make that a registrable, that's what makes that different. But to your point, you're correct in the idea of false imprisonment. Should not be a registrable offense. And I want the court to consider what the state is saying here is not that there has to be a conviction. They're saying you have no due process rights at all before you're being required to register. You do not have a liberty interest. So if the state were to say, for example, if teachers, we believe teachers commit more predatory offenses than anyone else, so we're requiring all teachers to register. According to the state's analysis, you do not have a liberty interest. The state says you do not have a liberty interest in not being required to register. So I think it's appropriate, it is incumbent upon this court to start looking at these cases to make that hard determination.
Well, and to be clear, I wasn't opining as to whether or not it should or should not be a registrable offense, but rather pointing out that that's something that isn't for us to say, because it's the legislature that gets to decide what is included and what is not.
And I would respectfully disagree in that I think this court has the obligation to mm-hmm. say if this violates somebody's constitutional rights, it does, the legislature can say this is what we believe people should be required to register. This court is obligated to say within the confines of the Constitution.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal, and counsel for respondent, go ahead and adjust the podium and go ahead and start when you're ready.
Excuse me. Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Assistant Attorney General Angela Kiza, appearing on behalf of the BCA in this case. I want to start out by addressing a couple of the things that came up in appellant's argument. First of all, under the statute, under the 243-166, over the years, that statute has evolved. And while it may have started particularly because of a child abduction situation, it has expanded over the years. It started out with only kidnapping of minors or false imprisonment of minors, and it went to adults. And they have expanded it, and it's not just a sex offender registration statute. They've expanded it to particularly predatory offenses such as kidnapping and false imprisonment and things of that nature. And to Judge Wheelock's point, that is something that the legislature, it's their responsibility to do. Appellant cites the legislative working group in his brief, and I was actually a co-chair on that group, and false imprisonment is something in that report that they did look at, and I think that currently the legislature is looking at, but that's for them to decide. And even I think the pending legislation is forward-looking, so it wouldn't affect this case as far as registration is concerned. But in any event, the statute as it's written clearly applies to Mr. Jefferson, and the BCA is not in the business of deciding, oh, well, in this case, maybe he shouldn't have to register, but in this case, it was 10 years later, so then he should register. They have to look at the statutory language, and they have to apply it as it's written. Under 299C, they're charged with administering the registry, and to do that, they can't look at individual cases and decide whether they think somebody should have to register. In that case, maybe they see somebody who's registering for second-degree criminal sexual conduct, but they don't think it's all that bad. Well, then let's not have him register. So it would be opening a whole floodgate to say they have any kind of discretion. In this case, the statute applies to Mr. Jefferson, and that's what the BCA did. They applied the statute to him. The charge, the third degree, and I don't even necessarily know if false imprisonment would be considered necessarily a lesser, but it was an amended charge. He was charged with false imprisonment. He was convicted of false imprisonment. And then later, under 243-167, which was not applied in an ex post facto manner, it was applied, in 2019 to something that happened in 2019.
Ms. Kiza, can I ask? I want to get to that authority, because I don't know exactly what oath a commissioner takes. I assume it's to the the laws of the state of Minnesota and the Constitution. And I may be wrong about that, but if we just start from that basis, wouldn't that provide a bit of inherent discretion? And we got such unique facts here, given that it wasn't registrable, and the offense he was recently convicted of is not registrable, but because the one before is, and that's a person crime, you got to go through all these hoops, dots to get to the point of registration. And we've seen the cases too where the BCA will look retroactively at a file where an offense was dismissed and determine it was part of the same circumstances, and then require someone to register. In other words, there's discretion being used there. So why wouldn't there be authority and discretion in the very unique circumstance like this to say, no, we conclude it would be arbitrary and capricious, we're not going to require it?
Well, in this case, and actually different than the same set of circumstances case, in this case, the statute, the wording on its face plainly applies of 243.167. There's, you know, all of the requirements of that statute clearly apply. There's no discretion. You know, he has the conviction for the crime against the person. He had the prior conviction under 243.166. At that time, he was not required to register because the law did not apply to him. And it also applies if somebody's already finished registration. So all of those things, it wasn't anything. 243.167 doesn't give them any kind of discretion. And 243.166 doesn't either. Same set of circumstances has been defined by our Supreme Court. In the Lopez case, they address the same set of circumstances. And again, more recently in the Berry case, they address the same set of circumstances. So the BCA can't disregard what the statute says even about that and what the case law says about that. But in this case, there's 243.167 doesn't even give that kind of leeway. And I wouldn't even call it discretion. They apply the law as the law has been interpreted on the same set of circumstances in those kind of cases.
Well, and I don't see that being disputed so much. I was just interested in that concept of the oath that one takes as a commissioner to the Constitution, which can be cases like this where you look at the facts and just conclude, despite the clear application of the statute, that it's unconstitutional. I was just curious. I mean, obviously our court or Supreme Court could do that, but.
Right, and it's not unconstitutional, as we argued in our brief, with respect to the different constitutional arguments. And if you look at the standards, that was not met in his case. With respect to due process, if you look at the law, and as Judge Schmidt pointed out, you know, the standards that our Supreme Court has set forth, Mr. Jefferson's case doesn't meet those standards as far as anything being applied unconstitutionally.
Counsel, is there any case along these sets of facts that you are aware of where somebody pled guilty to a crime that then the law changes and now that is something you have to register for?
Well, that often would happen in 243.167 cases, because that's kind of the whole point of that look back in 243.167, is it catches that population of people who have the offenses, but the statute didn't require registration at the time that they pled guilty to those offenses. And then they commit a crime against the person as defined under 243.167. So that would happen, I'm not saying often, in the scheme of all the registered offenders, it's the numbers are not that high, but that would, or is that what you're asking?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to get to. But do you have any specific case that you can cite where it was, there was, at the time that they were convicted, they did not have to register. They commit a new crime later, and then now they have to register because the law changed in between.
And you're talking about an appellate case?
Yeah.
Not that I can think of. I mean, there are cases that have addressed 243.167, but not in that context. Not
okay.
In that
context. Because appellant's counsel makes some compelling arguments that there's something fundamentally unfair here, that had he just pled guilty to the charged offense, he would not be registering. The state offered him a deal, whether it's lesser or not, but a deal, and he took it, And now all of a sudden, years later, he has to register.
Well, right. But the same point would be for anybody who applied or who pled guilty to false imprisonment at that time, whether it was an amended offense or not, or an amended charge or not. Let's say they were charged with kidnapping and false imprisonment and they pled to false imprisonment. So that would be the lesser one, right? I mean, they also would be required. So it's not, he's not being treated any differently than anyone who was convicted of false imprisonment before the statute began to apply to false imprisonment of adults. You know what I mean? If they then commit a crime against a person under 243-167.
For sure. And I'm not saying that he would be treated differently from anybody else in that context. But that's why I asked about whether there's any appellate cases you're aware of, because there does seem to be, there's a compelling argument there that there's something unfair here, that he pleads guilty, he knows the consequences of the time that he's convicted, and then years later in between the law changes and now all of a sudden he has to register for this offense.
But then I would say anybody who's required to register under 243-67 could say the same thing. Before false imprisonment applied, they pled to false imprisonment. So that whole group of individuals would say it's unfair. At the time I pled, I didn't have to register. That's unfair.
Right.
And that, so 243-167, I mean, it's retroactive by nature. It's my understanding is it's intended to capture those who didn't have to register at the time and then later commit a crime against the person. So anybody, I think, would say it's.
Yep. I think anybody.
Say it's unfair.
Sure. Anybody within that category of people would say that's unfair, but how does that comport with substantive due process, where they didn't have an opportunity at the time, they weren't aware of the fact that this was registrable because it wasn't at the time?
Well, I mean, I think, again, it gets to the rational basis for the statute, and the statute is based on the risk, at least as the legislature sees it. And I think it's a pretty high bar to show that the legislature just has to have some reasonable basis, for thinking that these particular kinds of offenses have to require registration. That's for 243-166, but also for 243-167. The legislature has to have some reasoning to think that you want to track registered offenders if they continue to commit crimes of whatever nature, down the road. And that's something that, and I cited just the Vaughn case for that, because that was the one that I thought was, I guess, the most on point as far as that kind of reasoning goes. But so I think that survives the rational basis for the statutes.
But getting back to the unique facts here, and maybe this gets more to the ex post facto, part of the argument, but isn't that true only with someone who actually is convicted of a registrable offense? At the time of his conviction, he was not. He successfully completes his probation. He's long discharged and then has this new offense. And so does the same rational basis apply? Because, 10 years from now, there might be some new offenses. I suspect that some would argue, and maybe the legislature will suggest, that it we now need to track these individuals, but today I'm convicted of that offense, and so it's just a whole different realm, isn't it, of the rational basis, rather than starting today or when the change takes place. And so that's the unique thing of 167, and why I suppose everyone would say it's unfair, because on its face it seems unfair, which then gets us to whether the rational basis answers that unfairness.
Right. So then this kind of gets back into this being an error correcting court. But the 243-167, then I think you have to look at that kind of in conjunction with 166 as far as the rational basis goes. Because, there's the rational basis for 166 as far as these are certain offenders that the legislature, thinks should be tracked for law enforcement supervision purposes in general. Right, but then 243-167, the rational basis for that is, as I said with Judge Schmidt, it goes to kind of the longevity of in the, you know, offenders being in the community, and are they remaining, you know, crime free? And it's limited to crimes against a person or, you know, the more serious crimes. So there is a rational basis for looking at that when you, because time in the community, you know, unsupervised or supervised, crime-free, reduces risk of recidivism, you know, all of that. So there is a rational basis for that, for 243-167, which is why they then, you know, brought back in people who were registered and completed or hadn't been required to register if they committed these crimes against the person.
Would it be a little tighter argument if the offense that's more recent offense is not just a person crime, but a registrable offense, and now we're going to expand the registration period from 10 to the, because now you have two, because retroactively, but at least they're both tied directly to the rational basis of the registration.
Right, which 243-166 already does. The second crime, registration crime, then extends registration from 10 years to lifetime. So that already does kind of address that issue.
But here, the point being of these unique facts is that neither offense at the time they're convicted of are registrable. But because now the other one has become one, and now this one's a person crime, you do it together, and again, mm-hmm. you get further away from the rational basis of a list of registrable offenses, don't we?
Well, I would argue that 243-167 still has the rational basis, as I said, of the longevity in the community and bringing those people back in. So, and then that kind of piggybacks on to 243-166's rational basis already as far as tracking offenders in the community for law enforcement purposes. So I think combined and separately that they meet the rational basis standard. And I see I've got 5 seconds left, so unless somebody has another question, I will conclude.
I'm not seeing any other questions.
We just ask for you to affirm the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. A couple points. First, this case is unique. I have not seen any cases from appellate courts where this person, and what makes it unique is that the charged offense is not a registrable offense. He pled guilty to a lesser offense, and looking at the plea petition, it clearly and explicitly states that it's a lesser offense. So he's pleading to a lesser offense, in which case, if he had pled to the original charge, he would not have to register. So that's what makes this irrational. We're not looking at this person as to whether he's supposed to register or not. What we're trying, it's like they've decided simply because he pled guilty to a lesser offense, this alchemy, as Judge Leader pointed out, of these two offenses, which are predatory offenses. Somehow putting these two together, it becomes a predatory offense. And that doesn't survive rational basis. I want to briefly address you. It's intriguing about whether the BCA has the discretion. And the statute doesn't really, and from my review of it, decide what discretion the BCA has. It does say a person shall register if they met these circumstances. But I would suggest that, in fact, now that I think about it, is that it's like a prosecutor has the discretion, because the law is, you could present a case where this person has done A, B, and C, and the prosecutor still has the discretion. That's all true, but because of, we think the search was unconstitutional, they still have the discretion. And in looking at the statute, it would appear that, in fact, the BCA may have that discretion. It's not something I've researched, but it doesn't say that the BCA does not have any discretion. It does not say the BCA must make people register. What it says is a person shall register, which seems to be different. Finally, I just want to, the council has admitted that they've extended the scope of registration, but you'll notice that she didn't explain what's the basis for that. She didn't say, and we're expanding the basis because it's proved to be effective in keeping track of people. It's proved effective in making sure that certain people are registered to law enforcement. They have not been able to point to a single case, not one, where registration has resulted in charges. all what we've done is expanded to include more and more people without any indication that any type of registration has proved effective. I believe that this case violates Mr. Jefferson's constitutional right to substantive process, and I ask the court to reverse the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both, counsel, for the arguments, both today and in the briefs, and we will have an opinion out in the statutory timeframe.
Thank you.
This case is submitted. Thank you.